So the prac comes in a little less than 2 weeks, right? 2 weeks from right now, you'll be well into it. We have two things left to do. We have to study the skeleton. And we're going to do that in two parts, not only because there's a lot of information in the skeleton, but makes sense to do so because the skeleton overall is broken into two major parts. What are those two major parts? Axial skeleton and appendicular skeleton, correct. So we'll do the axial skeleton today, appendicular skeleton next time. The distinction and the reason for the names is that the axial skeleton is the part of the skeleton on the axis of the body, the midline. It forms the axis of the body. So it includes, well, whereas the appendicular skeleton is appended onto the axis, it includes the bones of the appendages. But what's included in today's stuff, the axial skeleton, are the bones in the head, which includes the skull, but also six very tiny auditory ossicles, which are in the head, but they're not really skull bones. They're inside the middle ear, by far the smallest of the human bones. The malleus, incus, and stapes are the three types of auditory ossicles, but of course there's a left and a right version of those. Then you have the skull bones themselves. You also have the hyoid bone, which is, its claim to fame is it's the only bone that doesn't articulate with another bone. It's just held in place by soft tissues that connect to it, muscles and tendons, ligaments and tendons, I should say. This is the hyoid that I'm moving right here. And so on an articulated skeleton like this, whether it's a real one or a fake one, they're usually just wired in place right there because that's where it is in an intact human. But it's not actually connected to one of these bones. They just have to wire it somewhere. So that's included. Also are the bones of the vertebral column. And those come in three categories for the still separate vertebrae. Then there are fused sections at the bottom, the sacrum and the coccyx. Those are all included in the axial skeleton as well. What else? Ribs and the sternum. So that's all the stuff that you need to learn today. And by learn, I mean not just the names of the bones. Many of these bones also have important features on them. And so that's a lot of your list, actually. The bones themselves, the names, that's not all that difficult. But one thing that's different about today compared to previous, the stuff we've been doing up to now, is that the number of terms that you need to learn is drastically increased. Your lists are longer now for the skeleton. And that can run you into trouble depending on how you go about things. They're all, you know, they're weird names compared to everyday language. And there's a lot of them, like I said. So if you make the mistake of just treating these things like they are just strings of letters that don't mean anything, then that's really no different. It'll be just as hard as it would be to memorize an equal number of telephone numbers that don't have any meaning, right? They're just random strings of numerals. That will make it a hell of a lot harder to do if you treat it that way. So it's really worth your time to try to learn about what the meanings of these words are. They'll stick in your head. They'll remind you where they are. It'll just be a lot easier. Plus, the more and more of these roots that you learn, when they pop up in different parts of the body, you'll have a lot easier time when you encounter those same roots again in a different word. But I'm not going to stand here and point out everything that's on your list today. It would take a long time for one thing, and I don't think you want me to do that, especially when me pointing them out is really no different from a picture already pointing them out, which you can follow along. But I am going to say some basic things, and I'm going to talk about the skull and the vertebrae a little bit. One thing is that for the skeleton overall, not just tonight's stuff, but next week's as well, there are some words that we reuse over and over. Some general words, in other words. And these include things like process. Now, I've talked about processes before, cell processes, right, in lecture. And that's a different word from process, meaning how to do something, right? Process, in this use, is the noun form of the verb process. To process means to stick out. So I've talked about cell processes, like a cell process of an osteocyte is the part that sticks out from the main part, which is in the lacuna. The cell process is the part that extends halfway through the canaliculus, right? That's something that sticks out from the main part of the structure. Well, there are bony processes as well. Most bones have something sticking out from the main part of it, and therefore those things are examples of bony processes. Some bony processes are called processes. There's just some word that comes before that, because there's all kinds of different things that are named a process. They have a specific name using an adjective that comes before the word process. But that's all a bony process is, something that sticks out from the main part. And some things are actually called processes. Sometimes we give them still other names. For instance, a condyle is a process. It sticks out, but it's called not a process, it's called a condyle instead. In fact, I actually even mentioned this today. What did I say a condyle means? Are you saying words?
Yeah, I've been up there, right? So.
What did you say?
Rib?
No? No?
Cartilage?
No, that's not what I said condyle means. It is, a condyle does have cartilage on it. It means knuckle. Remember I was talking about condylar synovial joints, otherwise known as ellipsoidal? So there are condyles on many bones. And that is a special kind of process. Bony process. Condyles specifically are always going to be smooth because condyles are always involved in highly movable articulation. So they have articular cartilage on them in life, in a living example, and they need to be as smooth as possible to be friction-free. On the other hand, epicondyles is another special name for some processes. Epicondyles are not condyles. They're just named epicondyles because they are near condyles. They're right above the condyle, which is literally what epicondyle means. Just like epidermis is above the dermis. So don't be confused by that. Think about what epi means, right? Epicondyles and condyles are kind of opposites. Condyles are always smooth because they're articular. Epicondyles are always rough. That roughness provides a lot of little nooks and crannies for the thing that connects to that epicondyle, which are ligaments and tendons, to get really a good hold in there and connect well. They're not involved in articulation. Their connection points. There are also several words that get reused that are not actually structures, but they're spaces. Just like lacuna and canaliculus, not really structures, they're space, named for spaces, right? One example of a name for a space on a bone is fossa. F-O-S-S-A. So there are all kinds of different fossae with different names depending on what bone you're on. And we call these things fossa, which has the same root as in fossil or fossorial. Some animals are fossorial. That means they dig burrows. Fossils are things that we dig up. Fossil fuels are called fossil fuels because we dig them up. The root of fossa means dig. And so a bony fossa is a shallow depression on the surface of the bone, named a fossa because it looks like someone dug out some of the bony material. It doesn't go all the way through. It doesn't penetrate, but it's a depression. On the other hand, there are some places where there is a true hole in a bone. It goes all the way through. And those have different names depending on the situation. General name for a hole in a bone, though, is there are several, like I said. One is canal. Another is foramen. Another is fissure. And still another is meatus. Those are all spaces, not actual structures. A foramen is a hole in a fairly thin part of the bone. So it's kind of like a window in a wall, and you actually see all the way through it. For instance, each vertebra has what's called a vertebral foramen in it, which is the hole through which that part of the spinal cord travels through. The plural of foramen, by the way, is foramina, in case you see that word. A canal, on the other hand, still another name for a hole through a bone, goes all the way through, but usually a canal will be through a deeper part of the bone, and it might take some twists and turns, so you might not actually see all the way through it, even though it goes all the way through, just like you might not see the end of a tunnel through the other end, because it can turn. And then fissures, that's just a general word for crack, right? There are certain cracks. Could you give me that white skull? For instance, in the orbits, these are called orbits, by the way. The eye sockets are orbits, named for the fact that they hold the orbs. Orbs are spheres. The eyeballs are the orbs. So the sockets are the orbits. But in the orbits, you have a superior orbital fissure and an inferior orbital fissure. They are just wide cracks. They're not nice holes, which would otherwise probably be called foramina instead of fissures. So those are spaces. And there's an acoustic meatus, another name for a hole through a bone. That allows for... that's part of the ear, basically. Acoustic meatus. So those are all names of spaces. And like I said, these words are used over and over because they... several different bones will feature them, and so there will be specific fossae, specific processes, specific condyles, etc. And whatever the word is that comes before those general words really tells you something about that. Sometimes it's named for the bone it's on, sometimes it's named for a bone that it connects to, but it will make sense, and try to learn why it makes sense. That will really help you study it. All right, let's talk a little bit specifically about the skulls then. Skulls and vertebrae I want to discuss a little bit because they're the skull is usually the most difficult part of tonight, simply because it's a lot of different bones and bony features in a small space. The other bones are a little easier to understand. But each table has a life-size model of the skull. But then also the smaller color-coded one, which is proportional. It's just scaled down in size. The nice thing about the colored ones is that the different colors show you where the bone begins and ends and another bone starts. Not only that, they're actually labeled on here, although not every skull bone is labeled on these little cheap models. These do come apart, but you should not take them apart. Keep them together because every time they're taken apart, they just get weaker and weaker, and eventually they will just fall apart. So keep these together, but use them. Now, in class today, in lecture, I think I mentioned, I'm pretty sure I mentioned, that the skull itself, the skull overall, consists of two major parts, right? What are those?
The cranium and the face.
Right, the cranium and the face. And what is the essence of the cranium? What makes it the cranium? Right, all of the cranial bones are in contact with the brain, at least partially. And so there are eight bones that do that, that contact the brain, and there are eight, therefore, eight of the skull bones form the cranium, or the brain case. The facial bones, the bones of the face, in other words, are none of those contact the brain. There are 14 of those. They all hang on the cranium. So that's the distinction between the two parts. Skull bones in general, whether they're cranial or facial, can be either paired or unpaired. The unpaired ones, there's only one of. The paired ones, there's a right and a left version, right? And so they're symmetrical.
So you don't count those, or you count those as a pair? Like, you know, like you said there's eight, so does that mean there's, is that two, or just like one is a pair?
A pair equals two.
Okay.
And so there are both paired and unpaired ones in the cranium itself, for instance. So if you look at it from the back, this dark green one, the very back of your cranium, is the occipital bone, coming from a word occiput, or a root occiput that means base of the neck. That's an unpaired one. And so hopefully it makes sense to you that any unpaired bone, being only one, is going to be straddling the midline, right? You're not going to find an unpaired bone on just one side because we're radially symmetrical, bilaterally symmetrical. So all of these unpaired bones will be centered on the midline, like the occipital, and also on the very front, it's another unpaired one, the frontal bone, aptly named, right? Although the frontal, just like the mandible I was mentioning in class today, the frontal in early development starts out as two separate bones, right and left. But in adulthood, it's one bone because the two fuse together. So what is the joint between what were the two halves called then? What's that an example of? It's not a suture.
What's the question again?
What is... Not a fontanelle. A fontanelle is a soft spot. I'm saying there's one frontal bone now, but it used to be right and left halves that fused together. So what is that joint between the two halves called now? What are you saying? Did everyone hear that?
No.
Of course not. What are you saying? I don't know. I didn't hear you yet either. It is synostosis. Yes. Synostoses are bony joints. They're no longer really a joint between two bones. They've fused two bones into one. So that's why we have one frontal bone. That's unpaired as well. So that's two of the eight. We have two parietal bones, though. One on either side. And parietal bones are well named. Parietal means of a wall. So the parietal forms the right and left halves or walls of the cranium. Okay, so that's four. There are also two temporal bones, this one and this one. Now, what does the word temporal mean? As opposed to spatial, for instance. Spatial and temporal are often mentioned together. Right, time. Spatial means in space. Temporal means in time. Well, the temporal bones and the temples of the body are named that because, in males especially, the graying of the hair usually starts right there at the sideburns, which is an indication of time. So that's why they got their name. So that's six, and that leaves two more for the cranium itself, which aren't as easy to see unless you look closely. If you look through the nasal cavity, toward the top of the nasal cavity, you see this greenish one. That's the bottom of what is called the ethmoid bone. And if you open up the lid of this one, you can see the top view of the ethmoid bone, although it's not its own color. It's this area right here. And by the way, make sure you look in the manual at the very good pictures of each bone in isolation. It shows you how it looks just by itself. Anyway, that ethmoid bone gets its name. Well, the oid ending always means like something, right? Ethmoid means like a sieve. What is a sieve? A filter, right. A sieve is something that's full of holes, like a colander. And so ethmoid means full of holes, really. Well, you don't really see it on this plastic version, but on a real skull, the ethmoid includes a horizontally arranged kind of shelf called the cribriform plate of the ethmoid bone. Cribriform, by the way, is another word that means full of holes. Ethmoid and cribriform both really mean the same thing, just with different words. The cribriform plate, though, if you look at it, is perforated with a bunch of little foramina, another use of the word foramen. Those foramina are passageways for tributaries of the olfactory nerve to go from the nasal cavity to the brain. Because the brain's in here, the nasal cavity's in a different compartment. So anyway, that's why it's called the ethmoid. By the way, if you look at it in isolation, it's about the size and the shape of a walnut. And so it has that cribriform plate. That's what really makes it ethmoid. It also has this vertical blade-like process sticking up from the main part. That's called the crista galli. Crista galli means what? Anyone know? What does gallus mean? What are galliforms? Chickens. Crista galli means rooster's crest. Just like the flap that's on the head of a rooster, that's the rooster's crest. Well, that's sticking up just like that from that bone. That's why it's called the crista galli. So that's seven. And then the eighth cranial bone is the one that you can see if you open up the jaw from the bottom. You can see it in this bluish. That's one view of it. You can see it from the side a little bit too. And when you look at it from the top, it would be this whole region right here. That's the sphenoid bone, which in isolation, most people think it looks either like a butterfly or a bat. But sphenoid, the name, once again, that oid ending means it's like something. Sphenoid means wedge-like. But it's not really because the sphenoid bone is shaped like a wedge. It's kind of an indirect way of naming it. The sphenoid is known as the keystone of the cranium. So then what is a keystone? But I mean in masonry, what is a keystone? A keystone is called that because it's the most important stone. But the keystone is the middle top stone in an arch. And when we talk about computer images being keystoned, it's because one edge is longer than the other. It's wedge-shaped. So the reason it's the keystone in an arch is because if you don't have it there, the whole arch topples, falls apart. Well, the sphenoid is called the keystone of the cranium. There are eight cranial bones. It's called that because all seven of the other ones connect directly to the sphenoid. So the sphenoid holds the whole cranium together, basically. And so it's not really wedge-shaped, but since it's called the keystone of the cranium, they gave it a name that means wedge-like. Those are the eight cranial bones. Now, the facial bones, we have also paired and unpaired ones. We have one mandible, although as I said, that starts out as two halves as well. So here's another synostosis right in the middle. One mandible, though, and two maxillae. So the jaw really has three bones, two on top and one on the bottom. You also have nasal bones that are paired, right where you would think nasal bones are, right at the nose. Not listed on this little model, but they still exist, of course, are two lacrimal bones. Does anyone know what lacrimation is? Crying, good. And lacrimal bones are named that because they appear right where the tears come out. So this is a lacrimal bone, this is a lacrimal bone. They're just not detailed on this version. And they're really small, just like the nasal bones are. You also have some nasal conchae inside the nasal cavity, which are also not labeled here. And if you look at it from upside down, this greenish one that you can see the beginning of comes to a point in the nasal cavity. On the white one, the back of it, see this thin plate right in the middle? That's the greenish part on the other one. So if we're looking at it in profile, it would start wide right here, and then as it comes forward toward the nasal cavity, it comes to a point. And it's very thin in this plane. Well, that is shaped like an old-fashioned plow blade. And it's called the vomer, which means plow. That's another facial bone. And there are palatine bones as well, making up the hard palate. Did I miss anything on the face? Oh, yeah. Zygomatic bones as well. There are two zygomatic bones, right here and right here. They're facial bones as well. Now, speaking of the zygomatic bone, that word has zygo as a root, which is the same root as in zygote, which is what you make when you fertilize an egg with sperm, right? A zygote. It's called a zygote because you have joined the egg and the sperm. Zygo means yolk, not Y-O-L-K, but Y-O-K-E. But what is a yolk? Exactly. It's a bar that you bind two oxen together with. So to yoke means to join. And that's why a zygote is called that. This part of the skull, which is partially the zygomatic bone and partially the temporal bone, this little bar, that's called the zygomatic arch because it looks like a yoke. And here's where you can get confused by terminology, but you have to pause and think about why things are named the way they are. The zygomatic arch is not the entire two bones. It's just this bar-shaped piece. It's made up of a process from the temporal bone and also a process from the zygomatic bone. Those processes, though, are not named for the bone that they are part of. They're named for the bone that they connect to. So this part of the zygomatic arch, which is part of the temporal bone, is called the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And this part, which is a process of the zygomatic bone, is called the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. Okay? But that makes sense. The reason that you don't really want to call it, you know, you could call this thing the temporal process, since it's on the temporal bone. But there are other processes on the temporal bone, like this one, which is the mastoid process, meaning breast-like, mast, just like in mastectomy. And so you wouldn't want to call it the temporal process. You call it the zygomatic process, and it uniquely identifies it. It's the only process on the temporal bone that connects to the zygomatic bone. That's why the rationale there. Okay, so that's enough for the skull, but of course there's more on your list. We talked briefly about the vertebrae. I said that the individual vertebrae, not the fused ones, the sacrum and the coccyx, but the ones that are individual vertebrae throughout life, there are how many of them, first of all? There are 24, correct. And those 24 occur in three groups. So what are the three groups? What's the uppermost group, the most superior group?
Cervical.
Cervical vertebrae. Cervical is the adjective of cervix. And what does cervix mean? It means neck. So that's why a neck is a narrowing between two parts that are bigger. That's why the narrowing of the uterus is called the cervix of the uterus, the uterine cervix. But this part on all of us, not just women, this part is the cervix, because it's a narrowing between the head and the trunk. So the bones there are the cervical vertebrae. How many of those are there?
Seven.
Yeah. Just inferior to that group is which, what next group? The thoracic vertebrae, named for the fact that they're in the thoracic region, the thorax. How many of those are there?
12.
There are 12, and what makes them thoracic vertebrae as opposed to cervical or lumbar is that the thoracic vertebrae connect to ribs, which make up the thoracic cage or the rib cage. Well, there are 12 pairs of ribs in a human, so there are 12 thoracic vertebrae. And then the inferior most of the just those three sets are the lumbar vertebrae, so that's the lower back ones. And so if you were to be confronted with an isolated vertebra and asked to say which of the three groups it belongs to, the best way of answering that is to ask yourself one question first. And that is the question is, does this vertebra have transverse foramina? Well, let me explain what those are. Of course, they are foramina. But every vertebra, whether it's cervical, thoracic, or lumbar, has processes that stick out right and left. These are called transverse processes. Okay? This one's a spinous process, which it also has, but the ones to the sides are transverse processes. All three kinds have those. But only the cervical vertebrae have holes through those processes, which are therefore called transverse foramina. Okay? Not only do only the cervical vertebrae have that, but all seven of the cervical vertebrae have transverse foramina. So if you ask that question to yourself first and the answer is yes, definitely you're holding a cervical vertebra. The reason that only the cervical vertebrae have those transverse foramina, by the way, is that they form passageways for important blood vessels that run along the neck. So you don't find that in the other kinds. Now, if the answer is no, there aren't any transverse foramina on this vertebra, then all you know is that it's not cervical. That means it could be thoracic or it could be lumbar. Now, the thoracic ones are defined by the fact that they articulate with ribs, and there are articular surfaces where the ribs meet them, but they can be hard to find on a given sample. So even though it is a definitive way of saying that what you have is thoracic, it's not as easy as just another little trick. Let me get out a couple vertebrae. This one's a cervical. I mean, this one's a thoracic, and this one's a lumbar. What usually works for people is to notice that the thoracic vertebrae look like giraffe heads, and the lumbar vertebrae look like moose heads. And they really almost convincingly do. So use that trick. By the way, the vertebrae in general are designated alphanumerically. So we have C1 through C7 for the cervical, T1 through T12, and then L1 through L5. And by the way, I don't know whether it'll help you or not, but one way of remembering how many there are of each one is that a lot of people eat breakfast at 7, lunch at noon or 12, and dinner at 5. Beyond those alphanumeric designation, in the special case of the first two cervicals, they also get their own names. This is one of them. Actually, I'll keep that in here. Here are C1 and C2. C1, by the way, is unlike any of the other vertebrae in that it does not have a body. The body is the load-bearing part. Like on a lumbar vertebra, you have very large bodies. The bodies get bigger and bigger as you go down the spinal column because they're bearing more and more weight. And those bodies are exactly what I was talking about today, where you find the fibrocartilage pads, those symphyses called intervertebral discs. But anyway, there's no body on the on this C1. What is the special name we give to C1?
Axial?
No. No, that's C2. This is the axis. C1 is the atlas. Name from mythology. What is the myth about Atlas? Holds up the earth, the globe. Well, the globe that's being held up by that bone called the Atlas is the skull itself. So the skull rests on top of the Atlas, and the rocking of the occipital condyles of the skull in these articular facets of the Atlas is what allows the yes movement, the nodding of the head. The second one, C2, gets a special name as well, which is axis. And that's because it forms a pivoting axis for twisting between atlas and axis. So that allows for the no. No is occurring not between the head and the vertebra. It's between the first two vertebrae. And the axis itself is formed by yet another process. This bony process is called the dens. What does dens mean? Well, the adjective of dens is dental. So what does dens mean? Tooth. Yeah, this is, it's not actually a tooth, of course, but it looks like a tooth. That forms the axis for twisting, and in a living human, there will be a band of ligament around the other side, keeping it in place. Okay, so those are the vertebrae. I think that's probably enough. I could go on and on, like I said, but you should actually look at the stuff. So I'll let you loose.